Medical information obtained from our website or the live show is not intended to be a substitute for professional care. If your pet has or you suspect they might have an illness or other medical condition, you should consult a health care provider. The opinions expressed on this radio program are not necessarily those of All Paws Pet Talk, this radio show, or their sponsors.
And now live in this studio, it's the All Paws Pet Talk call-in radio show with a valuable knowledge and expertise of our panel guests ready to take your calls. Listen for the phone number so you may call in live. Take it away, panel.
Welcome to All Paws Pet Talk Animal Rave. My name is Karen Watts. I'm also known as Karen at petoftheday.com. And Animal Rave is our book show here on All Paws Pet Talk. We're here today with Dr. Alan Hamilton, who is a brain surgeon and the author of Zen Mind, Zen Horse, The Science and Spirituality of Working with Horses. Welcome to All Paws Pet Talk, Dr. Hamilton.
Well, thanks for having me here.
So glad to have you. You know, and when I first saw the book, when I got it from your publishers, I thought, I am the perfect person to interview this author because I've loved horses my whole life, and I have actually had brain surgery. So,
oh yeah, that gives you the double qualifications.
That's right. So I noticed your other book is the author of The Scalpel and the Soul, which I am guessing is more human oriented.
Right.
And how did you begin? Have you been a horse person your whole life? How, a lot of people, when they said, what are you reading? And I said, I described it to them, and they said, that's weird. How can you be a brain surgeon and work with horses?
Right. Well, I've been training horses for 25, 30 years, but my grandfather was a cavalry officer and actually rode in the Spanish riding school. And so I suspect I got the gene. You know, there's some genetic thing because I was just absolutely horse crazy since I was born, and my grandfather did everything he could to encourage it after that. So I've been kind of immersed in the world of horses as best I could. I grew up in New York City, so it's not exactly the best place to start, but I went away to camp and then eventually moved out west where I could raise horses and train horses. And a lot of people say, well, you know, isn't that kind of weird? You know, you're a brain surgeon by day and you know, like Batman by night, not really, but, you know, horseman by night. And
right.
It sort of satisfies, I guess, a combination of, you know, left and one side of the world is my left hemisphere, which is all the hard science and the precision and the accuracy and the mathematics of neurosurgery, and then getting out with the horses is a chance to be kind of spiritually and emotionally and intuitively connected, which is very different from what I do during the day.
That's right. And, you know, there's a big difference between the fine and very precise skill you have to use as a neurosurgeon. I had an acoustic neuroma removed myself. And, yeah, I only have one ear that works, but that's okay. The other one still holds my glasses up, so.
I like the way you think.
And, you know, that's all so precise and so exacting.
Especially something like an acoustic. Very, very precise surgery. The kind of the epitome of microsurgical technique.
Yes, I'm very lucky in that I live in the Boston area. So when I was sitting.
I trained there.
Did you? Who did you train with?
I trained at the Mass General with Dr. Ogerman, who's one of the most famous acoustic surgeons of all time.
And he did my acoustic neuroma surgery. So.
Did he really? Oh,
he
Dr.
Really
Ogerman
did.
Was my mentor for years. So, see, it's a small world. You got the best of the best.
That's right. Well, that's one of the good things about living where I live. People from all over the world flew in to have him do their surgery, and I just happened to, you know, he was here for me.
I was his fellow for a year. So, you know, I know Dr. Ogerman, knew Dr. Ogerman. He passed away recently, but I knew Dr. Ogerman and loved him very much. But, you know, people say the same thing about, I can tell you that neurosurgery is very precise, but like anything else, when neurosurgery is going well, it's a flow state. It's like everything is happening without you really having to think about it. You know, your moves under the microscope, they kind of just flow out of you. And the same thing with horse training. When horse training is going right, you're not even thinking about it. It's just flowing out of you. You're reading the animal. You can tell the slight give that the animals going to yield with the forequarters or the hindquarters, and you can feel it coming before it does, and your release and your timing is perfect, and so they're not that different. I mean, the scale is, and of course the precision is, but in a lot of ways, when they both go right, when they're both perfect, they're both flow states.
That's right. And, you know, a lot of times when I was trying to describe, it's a very thick book. We're on the radio, so people can't see. It is, how many pages is it? It's a little over 300 pages. So,
and beautifully illustrated. Beautifully illustrated book with all of the diagrams in the book were watercolors. So we have these incredible, beautiful watercolor illustrations. And it really talks about how to approach the horse and think about the horse and develop relationships about the horse and work with the horse, all in a way that's really never been done before. And of course, it's magnificent that it's all illustrated with these beautiful handmade watercolor paintings.
That's right. You know, I love the fact that, you know, as you described, the brain surgery is sort of, you talk in the book about left brain dominance in human history,
right,
and how important that is in the development of certain things, and how we kind of tend to ignore the right brain side. Well, I went to Mass Art, and I was a rarity there being right-handed. So many of my classmates were left-handed, they looked at me kind of funny. So,
right.
But we're like not the normal segment of humanity, pretty much.
I suspect that a lot of people who are pet owners or people who are really close to animals are much more right brain. In fact, when I give lectures in clinics, we do a lot of testing of who's left brain and right brain. Not that, it's a 5-minute test, paper test you can take online. But the point is, I think that there are certain people in life who are built and wired to feel much more connected more easily, and those people very often are animal lovers, amongst other things. But they have a sense of being able to connect and empathize with another life form very easily. And that quality of connection, that quality of seeing a relationship as a we instead of a me, that's a right brain characteristic. I would guess that as a rule, the people who are mostly attached and most closely derive satisfaction out of animals and profound companionships and training relationships, those are people who have an easier time getting into a right brain state, which is a nonverbal state. I mean, the animal is not listening to the words that you're saying. The animal is listening to the feelings and the vibes and the energy, the chi, if you will, that you're giving off while you're working with the animal.
Right. Tone of voice is way more important than the actual words that you're saying with any kind of animal.
I mean, there's a study that was done that showed that in a conversation or in a lecture, 70% of what we learn is nonverbal from their body language. The 20% is related to the tone in which they say it, and 10% is what they're actually saying. So it's only, 90% of the message that we get is not related to the verbal content of what people are saying.
Dr. Hamilton, we're almost out of time for this segment, but we have so much more to talk about. Will you stick with me?
Oh, you bet.
Okay.
I'm your Huckleberry. I'll be
right
here.
Right back with more All Paws Pet Talk Animal Rave.
This is Hanai of PeacefulPetMusic.com. Do you have a hyperactive or destructive pet? Now you can help reduce anxious behaviors by giving your pet relaxing Peaceful Pet Music CDs. Each CD uses acoustic vibrational therapy to help calm and soothe your pet, reducing stress and separation anxiety. And the beautiful music is made for the sensitive ears of your pet. Go to PeacefulPetMusic.com and use the code ALLPAWSRADIO for a 20% discount. That's PeacefulPetMusic.com.
Back to All Paws Pet Talk Animal Rave. And this is Karen Watts talking with Dr. Alan Hamilton of Zen Mind, Zen Horse. And we were just talking about how so much of working with animals, you know, tone, and even as you were mentioning, dealing with human beings, tone and intent is way more important oftentimes than the actual words we say. You know, one of the things I found fascinating about your book was that it really, it's the first time I really read of thinking of horses as prey and we as predators. I've had to explain that a lot to people about rabbits. I had a rabbit for 11 years, and I had to explain to them that, you know, rabbits do not like being picked up because they are prey to everyone else in the whole world. So if you don't support their feet, they're going to be panicky, and there's a reason for that. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to think of an animal as big as a horse as prey.
Well, they're the ultimate prey animal. You know, they have no defenses. You know, if you think about it, even a rabbit can do quite a number on you with its hind paws if it wants to. But, you know, the horse basically has one strategy, and that is, I got to run, and I got to get out of here. And so it's sort of the ultimate prey mindset, if you will. And what that does is it sets up a very different dichotomy, an opposite pole, like a north and a south pole for us. We're predators. We're based on language. We hunt in packs, like wolves, like orca whales, like. So we use very complex language for that. And whatever we want, whether it be me coming up and shaking your hand, or whether it be, you know, what I want in my career, or what I want, you know, if there's somebody in a crowd, that, you know, I walk directly up. I go directly after what I want, because that's what predators do. They lock on what they want, and then they go after it. Prey animals, it's the exact opposite. Anything that locks onto something and then goes towards it directly with purpose is a predator. So for a horse, everything's oblique. Everything is walk off to the side, relax, be disinterested, walk off to the other side, relax, be disinterested. And then eventually the horse goes, okay, he's not going to eat me for lunch, so he's safe. And what you learn from horses is what they want is peace and quiet. What their greatest reward is to have no pressure on them. You know, no threat, no predator. They're out there in a field with their buddies, and they can see for 100 yards in every direction. Everything's safe, and they go, "Oh, I'm at peace." And that is what a horse is looking for. And so it's almost the opposite. We want rewards, and horses want peace and quiet.
That's right.
We go directly towards things. Horses go obliquely towards things. It's a very nice balance, almost like a yin and yang balance, if you will, between an active way of looking at life and a passive way of looking at life.
That's right. I know even no matter what kind of animal you have, when you have children, when you're dealing with children, you have to teach them that, you know, yes, when you're talking to a person, the good thing is to go directly to them, look them in the face, look them in the eye. When you're walking up to a strange dog, that's not a wise thing. When you're walking up to a horse, that's not a wise thing. You have to approach animals differently and intentionally, much more than you do dealing with human beings.
Yeah, and I think that's right on. I think it's a great skill to teach a child, which is, you know, you see something that you want, don't just immediately rush over and pick the bunny up, or don't immediately go over and, you know, start moshing on the dog's ears, or don't, you know, I'm always amazed people go up and immediately walk over to a horse and put their hand right in the front on the forehead of the horse, which is their blind spot, you know, mm-hmm. And I go, well, you wouldn't like it very much if I came up to you and put my hand right smack dab in the center of your face when I wanted to say hello to you. So it kind of teaches you this, what does the world look like to other people? And coming at things with a soft, gentle approach is a very good thing to teach a child, which
That's
is
right,
be patient,
you know,
and sit and be non-threatening. And guess what? The world comes to your door.
That's right. I learned that the literally painful way and have the scar on my lip to prove it, because a neighbor dog got let loose for the first time, and Reggie was always in his yard, and I was a little kid, and I thought, great, Reggie came to play. So I walked right up to him, and I hugged him.
Yeah.
And I remember my mother very calmly explaining to me as she was, you know, wiping the blood off my face because any facial wound.
Right, and applying pressure.
Yep. And trying to explain to me that, you know, you don't know Reggie. Reggie doesn't know you. Reggie thought you were trying to squeeze him to death.
Yeah.
And so,
you know, I think one of the amazing things about horses, people will come and, pass me a train of horses, and they'll say something like, well, I can't get them to come to me. So I say, well, show me what you do when you go to catch and collect them. So they'll go out in the field, and they'll chase this horse all over. Hours. Yeah, okay, I get it. They don't want to come. They don't want to come. But the first question I ask is, do you ever go out and play with your horse? And they go, what? And I go, do you ever go out? I mean, you ever go out with your horse and just be happy to be with your horse? And they go, I don't know what you mean. And I go, well, here's the deal. If every time you walked into my room, you had a shovel in your hand and you said, you're going to work, after a while, I'd be looking to avoid letting you in the room with the shovel. So I said, why don't you play with your horse some more? And, you know, I think, again, this whole idea of when I'm trying to teach people how to get their horse to come to them, I go, the first thing you need to learn is to be disinterested in your horse. And I said, now walk out in your field and pay no attention to your horse and walk away from your horse. And what will happen is the horse will come towards them. Why? Because they have no agenda. The horse says, oh, my God, they're walking away from me. They can't possibly want something from me. I wonder what they're up to. And then they walk over. And I think it's not a bad skill to teach children that, hey, if you want an animal to come over to you, sit and be quiet. And just let that animal choose to come over to you, because curiosity, eventually the animal will go, that kid's not a threat. He's not coming towards me. So I always tell them, if you want the animal to come towards you, walk away from them and ignore them. And the reason is the animal goes, there's no threat there. They're walking away from me and they're ignoring me. And I think it's a good principle in life. I mean, being predators, we have not done well on this planet as the supreme predator. You know, we have altered our environment. We've consumed things beyond what we need. We've put things out of whack. And you sort of say, well, what do we need to change? Well, we need to be more of a herd. We need to be more prey animals and be thinking about what's good for the collective good and what does the herd need. And, might as a method, using physical power to make things happen doesn't work nearly as well as compromise and negotiation. So, you know, I think it's a very good time in history to sort of take a step back and say, hey, what has the predator philosophy gotten for us? And what can the prey philosophy do for us?
That's right. And, you know, this is this would not particularly be popular in politics right now to say, you know, you should think like prey and not like a predator. Right now, particularly, they all seem to be, you know, trying to out-predator each other and explaining.
Absolutely. But if I said, you know, you want to know what the trick is to bipartisanship, it's to think as a we instead of a me. It's to think about what's good for the herd. When the herd's looking for food and for browse and for good water and for shelter, it isn't one member of the herd that says, ah, ha, ha, I got mine. You know, it's not. That isn't the way it works. the interesting thing about horses is they think of themselves as a we. You know, even the horse that's alone in a paddock with just a human being taking care of it, that horse thinks it's a herd of two. It's my owner and me, and we're the herd. So horses are constantly in a we state of mind, not a me state of mind. And, you know, when people say to me, well, you know, would it be possible to live with a prey mentality? Of course it is. Of course it is, because you have to sort of think of what's the common good. And you know, leaders amongst horses are constantly asking themselves, is that person worthy of being my leader? You know, what I call the four C's of leadership, which is command, control, communication, and compassion. And you know, that's not a bad set of criteria to apply to our politicians either.
All right. We're out of time for this segment. Dr. Hamilton, will you stick with me?
Absolutely.
We'll be right back with more All Paws Pet Talk Animal Rave.
Your itchy dog allergy sad? Did you know that our dogs suffer from the same pollen, dust mite, and mold allergies that we do? Now, veterinarian dermatologist Dr. Christian has formulated Doggy Goo. Doggy Goo is a peanut butter treat for your dog. But Doggy Goo also sublingually builds tolerance to 10 pollens, 2 mites, and 3 molds 100% naturally. Try Doggy Goo. Your dog will Doggy Goo lick it up. Call 855-246-2426. The number again is 855-246-2426 or on the web www.healthygoo.com. Goo spelled G-O-O.
Scratch it.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
Get in on the fun and the rewards of caring for animals as a professional. Train to be a pet groomer or a veterinary assistant at the Florida Institute of Animal Arts. Turn your love for animals into a lifelong career. There are thousands of jobs in the growing professions of pet groomer and veterinary assistant. We help place graduates. Ask about tuition financing. The Florida Institute of Animal Arts, Winter Park, 407-869-PETS. On the web at myfiaa.com.
Welcome back to All Paws Pet Talk. We're speaking with Dr. Alan Hamilton, author of Zen Mind, Zen Horse. And one of the fascinating things I read in your book, which funny enough ties into the fact that you're also a brain surgeon as well as a horse person, is how different horses' brains are than human brains, in that the left brain and the right brain are not as connected with horses.
Right.
And that was just fascinating to me. It never occurred to me that...
You mean about the connection part?
Yeah.
Well, people wonder why, you know, for example, you can ride on a horse and approach a jump, and the horse will do really well when it's circling to the left, and then you come and circle to the right and try and take the same jump, and the horse balks. And the reason is that you and I have a bundle that connects the right and the left hemispheres that's extremely dense. So if I teach you how to, for example, remember the brains cross, so the right hand is connected to the left brain and the left hand is connected to the right brain. Well, if I teach you to eat with a fork in the right hand, you immediately know how to eat with a fork in the left hand because you took the information from the left side of the brain and passed it over to the right side of the brain. So the information became what we call generalized, okay? Well, with horses, they have a very poor connection. That connection is called the corpus callosum, and in horses, it's a tiny fraction of the size it is in human beings. So what happens when your horse is coming around from the left and sees the jump and does perfectly well, the reason it doesn't do well on the other side is it sees the jump as brand new. It's not like all those jumps on the left-hand side counted for the right side of the brain. So you have to teach everything that you taught to one side of the horse all over again to the other side. Quentin Anderson, who's a very well-known trainer and friend of mine, always says when you buy a horse, you always get two horses, righty and lefty. And, you know, you got to make sure to train both horses.
And
it's really
because...
quite true. You literally have to always train your horses on both sides, and generally, one side is dramatically worse than the other. So as a rule of thumb, I do about 60 to 70% of my training on the bad side of the horse and 30% or 40% on the good side of the horse. And that is the side where the horse does it more easily.
It's funny because that really explains something that I've known since I was a child but didn't know why. When my dad was a kid, there were a lot more farms around, and he loved to tell the story of the time where a new guy came to the town barn and said he was good with horses. And so the boss of the barn said, well, you take the two drafts out and hook them up. And he was good with one horse. And so he had no idea why the horses were giving him such trouble and why they would not move once he hooked them up to the yoke. Mm-hmm. And my dad, as a 12-year-old, knew that this horse goes on the right and that horse goes on the left.
Oh.
And have them reversed, and they're not going to know anything.
Oh, you know, and for draft horses, they know their position, and, you know, they're seeing everything. So it's as if that horse, that when he got switched to the other side, is going, holy smokes, what am I doing here? What are you doing here? We've never been here before. So that's a pretty cool story.
Which, yeah, and it's like one of the horses was righty and the other was lefty, and ne'er shall you cross the two. And, you know,
well, you know, this is why people sometimes sometimes people never train their horses to be mounted from the far side, you know, from the right side of the horse. And so everybody mounts a horse from the left side, and God help you if you're the first person who decided to try it out on the other side, because the horse will just have no idea what you're doing on that side. Everything has happened on the other side. So that's why it's kind of important to make sure you always balance your approach so you don't get into those problems.
Right, get into those bad habits. And that's why, you see, I know we all watched the Olympics this summer, and I had someone ask me, well, why do they go around one way and then go around the other way? Aren't they just doing the same thing twice? And as you just explained, it's not at all the same.
I was upset, by the way, with the Olympic coverage, because I didn't think there was enough equestrian coverage, personally. That was my. I was a little upset that we didn't get to see more of the equestrian events, but otherwise, the Olympics were wonderful.
And I loved having that all the horses had their own little hats with the little flags on them. And I thought, that must take as much training as some of the jumps do, getting a horse
absolutely
to allow you to cover its ears.
Yep, absolutely. And Ann Romney had a horse there. She has a very, very high-level dressage horse.
Yes, so there was a lot of following of equestrian from those sports and newscasters in Massachusetts, seeing as, you know, she's one of us. And one thing I also wanted to talk about before we run out of time completely here is treating grooming as a tea ceremony. And that's such a lovely way of thinking about it. It's so intentional. And what I also like in the book is we've spoken about the illustrations, but the illustrations are very clear and very simple to follow, especially if you're not a word person. Pictures help an awful lot. And, you know, like the illustrations on how to approach a horse's hooves, and that you approach a horse's front hooves differently from the back hooves, and left and right.
Yeah, the thing that, you know, if you think about it, ritual, whether it be something like setting up the table for Thanksgiving or whatever we do, ritual creates sacred space. That's what it does. And one of the things that I found with grooming is, you know, a lot of people carry out grooming. They go, okay, I'm going for a ride now. I need to brush my horse and throw the blanket on. And what I discovered was if I slowed myself down and I made every aspect of the grooming job almost like it's like a tea ceremony, and I would focus on every stroke and how I used the brush and how much dirt was dislodged and how I swept with the grain and how I soothed the hairs on the horse's hide. And I just, the more I got into the every detail, the deeper and deeper I could get into the ritual. And it finally occurred to me that that grooming was not something you do to get the saddle blanket on. The grooming was a ritual way of greeting your horse every day. And of sending your horse the message of I care about you, I care about your body, I care about you, I'm looking for cuts, I'm looking for scratches, I'm going to tend to every aspect and groom you to perfection before we go out, and this is my way of affirming to you that I'm of service to you. That,
right.
And it's a great way to start every day with your horse.
And it so affirms the connection between the two of you. Again, it's a peaceful time. It's not something you rush through. It's just an intentional thing. And, you know, if you go about that with horses or even any animal, if you make, you know, brushing your dog or grooming your rabbit, you know, not a chore, but a nice thing that the two of you do together, it's going to be better for everybody concerned.
Yes, and the more you get into the details, the more you're going to be amazed at the depth of the experience and how incredibly satisfying it is to you. I mean, I have found, like, I've gotten to the point where if somebody said to me, there's nothing else you're going to be able to do with a horse in the rest of your life except one activity, pick it, it would now be grooming, because it is so profoundly affirming to the horse that I am here to be of service to you.
Well, Dr. Hamilton, we are running out of time. I want to remind everybody the title of the book is Zen Mind, Zen Horse, and it is available anywhere books are sold. I'm sure Amazon.com, and Dr. Hamilton's name is spelled H-A-M-I-L-T-O-N if you want to look online for it that way. And do you have a website or any other place people
can contact
you? Yes, I
do. The website's easy. It's ZenMindZenHorse.com.
Excellent. I want to thank you so much for being with us today, Dr. Hamilton.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Karen. I appreciate it. It's been wonderful.
And thank you for all you do for the brains of the world as well.
Oh, you bet. You bet.
All right. Take care. Folks, we'll be back with more All Paws Pet Talk Animal Rave.
Now you can walk and exercise your pet no matter what your condition using the bike toe leash. There is nothing like the bike toe leash. It easily attaches to bicycles, electric scooters, and other mobility equipment. It acts like an extra left arm to communicate and to control your pet in the healing position. You can install it in minutes. The bike toe leash is recommended by trainers and used by owners and working dog handlers of all kinds. So now you can get out and have fun and exercise your pet very safely. Go to our website, www.allpawspettalk.com, and go to the sponsor page and hit the bike toe leash banner, or call toll-free 857-245-3364. That number once again, toll-free 857-245-3364.
Welcome to All Paws Pet Talk Animal Rave. I'm Karen Watts, Karen at PetOfTheDay.com, and I am very pleased to have with me now the author of A Parrot for Life, Raising and Training the Perfect Parrot Companion. The author is Rebecca O'Connor. Welcome to All Paws Pet Talk, Rebecca.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me, Karen.
You know, you are the very first bird person that I've had, parrot person I've had on the radio show, although I did interview the author of Enslaved by Ducks, and he had some parrots, too.
But you've been missing out, then.
That's right. Well, you know, publicists and publishers send me lots of dog books and cat books, but there are bird books out there, and I was so pleased to find your book and be able to have you on the show. Now, have you been a bird person your whole life?
I have. I was just kind of born this crazy, unfortunately. Fortunately for me, I think my parents would say unfortunately. But, it's been a lifelong passion. I trained birds professionally throughout my younger adult life, and now I just do it on the side. But they've definitely always been a part.
Now, I read in the book that when you were little, you would find chicks and raise them. Were these just, you know, birds that had fallen out of nests, or?
Yeah, you know, when you are the certified bird girl in the neighborhood, and this still happens to me to this day, anyone who finds a bird is going to bring it to you. I can tell you stories about the strangest things that have been left on my porch in bird cages.
And once you get that reputation, it's with you for life, I'm sure.
Exactly.
And how nice that you lived with your grandparents and your grandmother was afraid of birds.
Yes,
but,
my grandmother
she
was terrified of them.
That's so sad, but it's so good that she did not discourage you. You know, some grandmothers would have said, don't touch that dirty thing. You can't bring that into my house. But she recognized that, you know, you were a bird person and that was going to be it.
I think so. I mean, I think that everyone had a little bit of patience with me about the whole bird thing when I was growing up because it was so obviously important to me. I mean, my imaginary friends were birds. I was constantly looking up into the sky and stumbling over things. And so they were good people and they had a lot of patience with it.
And your first bird I read was a cockatiel that your grandmother, who was afraid of birds, actually bought for you. Now, that's a very special thing for a grandmother to do.
Indeed, and it was a lovely little bird. I had it for, I think, a good 13 years before it passed away, which is a nice long life for a cockatiel, but that definitely got me started down the parrot road.
You know, I was fascinated to read in the book that, you know, people have had parrots around them for about 3,000 years, and that they're really, the basis of keeping parrots as pets started in India, which was something I never knew, though I've had, my husband and I do petoftheday.com. You can nominate your bird for Pet of the Day, by the way, if one of your birds wants to be a star.
I might have a hard time choosing which one, but I will definitely consider that.
And we've had, you know, one of the first birds we had nominated from India was an Indian ring-necked parakeet, and I thought, well, they're named Indian ringneck parakeets, so obviously they must come from there, and actually they do. So it's interesting to see that's sort of where keeping parrots as pets originated.
In the literature that I've read, that's what I've seen. Obviously, you know, there's probably a lot of information that we don't quite know that hasn't been recorded, but parrots have been in people's houses and been given as gifts, you know, from one, you know, king or ruler to another for as long as there's been falconry. They've definitely been a part of many, many cultures.
And, you know, falconry is a whole other aspect that the book doesn't go into too much, but I know that you have done falconry yourself, and that's a very different mindset from raising and training your own perfect parrot companion.
It's a slightly different mindset. Surprisingly, it's very similar in a lot of ways. The main difference is that parrots are very social and they do seek out companionship and interact with you in a social manner like they would with a flock. But, you know, birds of prey are solitary. They don't really want to be pet or cuddled and they could care less if you're there. What they care about is whether or not they're going to get fed and they're comfortable. But outside of that, the thing that they truly have in common is that they're, you know, parrots are wild animals. They aren't like dogs or cats, which are domesticated. And therefore, we've bred into them some traits that we really appreciate and make them more manageable. Whereas a parrot or a peregrine falcon, they're both pretty much directly from the wild. Even a parrot's probably only, you know, filial generation 3 or 4 at the most. And so they act like wild animals, not like domestic ones. So in that way, the training can be very similar.
You know, it's funny. We have had all sorts of birds be featured on petoftheday.com. And one of the ones that we once had was a hawk, a red-tailed hawk named Isis, who has eye trouble, so she couldn't survive in the wild. But the person who nominated her was very clear in saying, Isis is not my pet. Isis regards me as her pet. Let's keep this clear from the outset.
Right. I do have dogs. I couldn't imagine living without dogs. But the relationship that I have with my falcon and my hawks and my dog is a very different one. You know, I do not consider my birds of prey pets. I consider them a responsibility. And a lot of times I'll be working with a bird that is, you know, has fallen from the nest as a baby or what have you and is being prepped to go back out into the wild. And there's still much to gain from that relationship. I mean, it teaches you a lot about training and trust and being honest in your interactions and just the challenge of having something that wild come to trust you, at least, is so amazing. But nope, they're definitely not pets.
And one of the things that really struck me in reading your book was, you know, I knew A Parrot for Life is the title of the book, and a lot of people don't know how long parrots can live, but I never quite put together the one thing that you put in a sentence, that parrot lifespans outlast most marriages.
Right.
I've never quite thought of it that way.
Yeah, I hate to admit it, but all three of my parrots, I've had all three of them for, 18 years now, and they've outlasted every boyfriend I've ever had. But, you know, I don't, and I'm not so sure that we are, as humans, really geared with our pets to have a relationship with a pet that outlasts, you know, the lifespan of a dog, which is, you know, for a really lucky dog in a breed that lives longer, you know, you're looking at 18 years, right, at the longest. And a parrot is going to quite possibly be around 3 to 4 times that length of time. And life
That's
changes.
Right. There are parrots who have lived into their 80s in some cockatoos and some of the African gray, some of the larger parrots. And so we actually have encouraged people to make sure that if you are buying a pet as an older adult, you make sure that there's a contingency plan, someone who is ready to take over that relationship if something happens to you.
Absolutely. And I think that we also need to be honest and have empathy for others about how that situation often shakes out, because the truth is we don't know what's going to happen in our lives over the next 50 years. And people are often put in situations where they do need to give up their parrot through no fault of their own, you know, whether it's the bad economy and having to move in with family members who can't deal with the parrot, or, you know, any number of medical tragedies or just, you know, day-to-day things that become insurmountable to keep that pet. So I think that we all need to be aware that if we have an animal like that, we need to know what we're going to do if we can no longer take care of it and have, like you said, a contingency plan.
That's right. Rebecca, we're almost out of time with this segment. Will you stick with me?
I think I will.
We'll be right back with more All Paws Pet Talk Animal Rave.
I'm hungry, can't wait. I'm hungry, lick the plate. I'm hungry, tastes great. I love food. I'm hungry, can't wait. I'm hungry, lick the plate. I'm hungry, tastes great.
Is your dog a finicky eater due to health problems, old age, or just fussiness? Super Gravy by Clear Conscience Pet will boost your pet's appetite and nutrition for less than 40 cents a day. If you are adding expensive canned food to kibble to get your pet to eat, Super Gravy is the earth-friendly alternative with no can waste and for less than half the cost. Visit supergravy.com for more info and bring pure joy back to your companion's mealtime. Now through Labor Day, save 20% on Super Gravy and all Clear Conscience Pet treats at Pet Food Warehouse in South Burlington and Shelburne.
I'm hungry, lick the plate. I'm hungry, tastes great. I love food. I'm hungry, can't wait. I'm hungry, lick the plate. I'm hungry, tastes great. I love food.
Does your dog have muddy, dirty paws? Well, here's your answer. The Paw Wash cleans dog's paws fast and easy. Just insert your dog's paw and leg into the device and pump up and down. The Paw Wash's unique hourglass design creates a suction of power that pulls that dirt, mud, sand, or salt off the paw and leg and it stays in the device. You can clean all four paws in a little over a minute with just one fill. For retail or online sales, go to www.thepawwash.com. That's www.thepawwash.com.
Welcome back to All Paws Pet Talk Animal Rave. We're talking about A Parrot for Life with Rebecca O'Connor. And one of the things I'd love to talk about is the different diets that different birds have. That's another thing you have to know about. You know, we always recommend that people do lots of research before they get any kind of pet. And birds' diets can really vary depending on what species of bird you're getting.
Absolutely. There are actually even some species, you know, there's a pretty big generalization of what you feed, but some species can be incredibly specific, like lories and lorikeets, which are, they eat fruit and nectar in the wild, and so they require a diet that is nectar-based. So you need to know, you need to do enough research that you're prepared for this.
That's right. And you need to know that if you're having a bird that's going to want to eat a lot of fruit, you have to be prepared to not only buy and prepare that fruit, but also be prepared to deal with when your bird decides to get creative and fling the fruit. You know,
right. And fruit flies and all of the sticky cleaning that comes along with that. So, you know, it's good to be prepared. But the whole parrot diet thing is very interesting because, honestly, we really haven't taken a hard look at what, you know, prepared diets parrots need until maybe 15, 20 years ago. Nutritionists started taking a really hard look at it. And we still have a lot of research to do because, like I said, all of the species come from different parts of the world. They eat different things. You know, they require different trace minerals, different levels of protein. And we really don't know everything yet. So,
That's right.
Are some really great pelleted diets available now. But you have to be ready to mix in all your own good stuff, too.
That's right. You know, if we think about it, even the species that we've already talked about, you know, some of the parrots that are from India are going to be very different in their dietary needs and requirements than the blue and gold macaws that we see in wildlife footage from Central and South America. You know, they're different parts of the world. There are different plants that grow. There are different things that they eat. And so if we're going to bring these wild animals into our home, we have to be prepared to deal with what they need.
Absolutely. Of course, the exciting thing is that now that information is so readily available, of course, you have to be careful with what you pull off the internet, but, you know, with Google Scholar and with, you know, looking into really great sources, there are wonderful papers and research that's being done that you can find readily on the internet. And so having a parrot is kind of a lifelong learning experience if you're willing to engage. And I think we all will find out a lot more about what our birds need, both physically and intellectually, as scientists do more and more research.
That's right. That's another. You'll become better friends with the manager of your produce department in the supermarket, just like I was with my rabbit, because of all the things I noticed that you can share with your bird, you can eat with your bird. A lot of them are vegetables and fruit. And so that's a good thing to know, that that's in the book, is a list of things that is okay and, in fact, good for parrots to eat. Another thing we need to touch on is what you just mentioned, is making sure your parrot gets what it needs intellectually, that it's not just, you know, you see in old cartoons the bird in the simple cage stuck there all day. Well, I'd go crazy if I was stuck in basically a shoebox size place all day with nothing to do. And your parrot can get emotionally troubled if it doesn't have enough to do to challenge it. And, of course, just like dogs, just like other animals, a bored animal is a destructive animal.
Very true. And, again, you know, exciting forward-moving science in the animal world. A lot of good things have come out of zoos where they've created enrichment programs, and we've discovered that there's a lot of things that we can do that are fun for us to engage in, too, that sort of simulate a parrot's day in the wild. Obviously, a parrot doesn't just sit on a branch eating nuts all day. They fly around, they explore, they, you know, investigate, they forage. And so knowing that you can hide food in a paper bag in the bird's cage, that you can hang food from the cage, that you, if you switch out toys at once a week or so, if not every 3 days, your bird will have things to do and have things to occupy its mind. And, you know, a busy beak is less likely to be a screaming beak, or chewing on the table leg beak. So keeping your bird entertained and giving enrichment is really important. And there's some great ideas in the book and a lot of great resources online as well.
Yes, it's funny because even my dad for one winter bird sat for his neighbor's parakeets when she went to Florida. She was afraid Pixie and Dixie wouldn't make the trip. And so it took a few weeks for them to make the adjustment to my dad, who is 6 foot tall and a big guy with a deep voice, whereas their owner is, well, I think Jeannie's maybe 5 foot one and female with a much lighter voice. But one of the things he would do is whenever he cleaned their cage, he would like move toys around and move the mirror, which was like, he was like, I was making a whole new world for them, and they'd be really mad, but then they'd be really busy investigating everything again.
Right. Right. Well, and we all need that, right? I mean, change is good. Change, the best, my experience, you know, having worked in shows and dealt with a lot of birds that got shipped all over the place, you know, into new environments constantly, the most well-adjusted animals were always the ones that saw a lot of positive change in their life. You know, obviously you don't want to terrify them or put them in situations where they're really uncomfortable constantly, but knowing that the world changes and it's interesting and having that sense of curiosity makes for a very well-balanced pet.
That's right. And it's interesting to see what not only you can teach your bird of any sort, but what you can learn from them and what you can observe from them, too. Because a happy bird is also less likely to indulge in self-destructive behaviors like feather plucking, which is just so scary and awful to see. And we see birds that end up in rescue. A lot of the birds who have been pet of the day are birds that ended up in rescue when they had problems from improper care. And, you know, when it gets so bored that it's plucking its own feathers, you know that's not a good situation.
Correct. And, you know, that is a situation that arises. And there's also, from time to time, birds pluck and we just don't know why. So anything that you can do to try to avert that from happening, especially with enrichment, a great diet, is really critical because plucking feathers is a lot like, you know, someone who has the habit of biting their nails all the way to the quick so that they bleed. You know, you might go through a phase where you paint your nails with sour apple and get yourself to stop biting, but the second you have stress again, you're right back to biting your nails. So it's more of a habit than although it can occasionally be medical. So, yeah, I mean, better to head it off at the pass if at all possible.
That's right. Keep your bird happy and keep your bird busy. And as we mentioned, you know, a busy bird is a less destructive bird. Although some birds, parrots in particular, I know absolutely love taking things apart with their beak. So it's important to give them toys that they can do that with.
Correct. Deconstruction is a part of being a parrot. So, you know, there's lots of things that, and lots of inexpensive ways that you can give parrots things that they can destroy and keep their little beaks happy. There's a lot of that in the book, but, you know, there's things like, you know, giving them branches from citrus trees that haven't been treated with any pesticides, or giving them a phone book, or there's lots of fun ways to give a parrot something that is acceptable that it can destroy.
That's right. Don't buy it a rope thinking that, oh, it's so pretty, it's going to hang in its cage forever, when the parrot's going to see that as, cool, I can pull that apart. That's going to be so fun.
Yeah. That just happened to me a couple weeks ago. You'd think I'd know better.
Well, you know, that's what pets do for us. They challenge us and teach us, even when we think we know it all already.
Absolutely. You know,
now, the book is called A Parrot for Life, and I know it's available on Amazon.com and anywhere books are sold. Rebecca, did you have a website that you wanted to mention?
Certainly, they can look me up on Heckled by Parrots, which is my parrot blog, just like it sounds, www.heckledbyparrots.com. There's a lot of good parrot information on there, and definitely keep an eye out because I have another parrot training book coming out from TFH, I believe, at the end of the year.
Excellent. I want to thank you so much for being with us, Rebecca, and we'll be back next week with more All Paws Pet Talk Animal Rave.